Well, what I want to present to you today is a subject that I have been aware of and thinking about and musing over for at least the last 60 years. And you might say, why haven't I spoken on this sooner? All things considered, well, let's say it was in a development process, a development that started in the middle 50s. When I first heard of this subject, I thought it fascinating at the time. And then less than a decade later, was reintroduced to the subject when I first became aware of the church and its teachings. The subject is the messages to the seven churches of Revelation. That category of work that we regard as explaining the seven church eras. Those of us who think that the seven eras were a unique teaching of the WCG may not be aware that this teaching, this idea, has a long history. Like I say, I first heard of it myself as a young person in a Baptist church in the middle 50s. Now, they explained the succession of eras using a different lineage than we might have. But the Baptists at least knew enough to not include the Catholic Church or any of its phases as a part of their understanding. They identified different groups of people, non-Catholics, to explain the development of those eras as they saw it. There's a book put out, it's called Letters to the Seven Churches by Sir William Ramsay, published first in 1904. And a friend of mine back in the middle 70s gave me a copy of that book as a gift. I still have it. But it's wonderful when in relating the historical and geographical situations in each of these seven churches that existed in Eastern Turkey. Wikipedia has this to say about the particular teaching. Some historicists typically interpret the seven churches as representing seven different periods in the history of the Western Church from the time of Paul until the return of Jesus Christ. Schofield states that these messages, by their very terms, go beyond the local assemblies mentioned. He is of the opinion that the letters have a prophetic purpose, disclosing the seven phases of the spiritual history of the church. Other writers, such as Clarence Larkin, Henry Halley, Merrill Unger, and William Branham, also have positioned the view that the seven churches preview the history of the global church. Notice they don't call it the universal church or the Catholic Church. They, too, recognized that the true history of these seven churches, which we call eras, were not through the line of the Catholic Church. Now, this has been understood clearly since the beginning of the 1900s. Schofield published his work. You probably are familiar with the Schofield Bible, and I believe about the early years of the 1900s. Another name, Henry Halley, you probably recognize Halley's Bible Handbook. Merrill Unger, Unger's Bible Dictionary. These are, you know, well-known scholars of the past 100 years or so. They too understood the prophetic application of these seven messages. Now, the Waldensian Church, we are familiar with them, and we have included them in our lineage of history. But the Waldensian Church had a symbol for their organization which shows them identifying themselves as Thyatira, at least the way I see it. They have a logo or a symbol that they use that shows them with their single-based candlestick illuminated, pointing directly to the fourth star. And the fourth star is, of course, the fourth era, which is Thyatira. Now, if that's the case, that proves that they understood the prophetic application of the seven church eras as much as 800 years ago. So it's not a new thing, and it's not something unique to the WCG, but it's something that has been generally understood for a long time, especially by those churches which comprised that history. And something else we should point out is that the seven candlesticks that we read of in Revelation chapters 2 and 3 describe candle holders that stand on their own individual bases. Dr. Hay pointed that out many, many years ago, probably in the early 70s that I recall him saying it. But the distinction between the Old Testament church and the New Testament church is that the Old Testament church was represented by a menorah, which is a single base that is supporting seven branches all off the same base. Whereas in the New Testament church, each church is represented with its own individual base. Now we can look in a place like Revelation 2, verse 9, that shows that. Revelation 2, verse 9, where he says, "I know your works," this is speaking to Smyrna, "I know your works and tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of them that say they are of Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan." That's not the verse I want. Revelation 2, 5, I'm sorry. Ephesus. "Remember, therefore, from whence you are fallen, and repent, and do the first works, or else I will come unto you quickly and will remove your candlestick out of its place." Now, this isn't talking about ripping an arm off of the menorah. This is talking about an individual, distinct, separate candlestick that can be removed from that particular church group. So think of them as seven individual candlesticks. That would mean that one is not necessarily directly connected to the other. That's another part of the picture that God gives to us. There are many people who have been turned off by this subject, and I would say it could be largely the result of the way that it was explained to us over the years. I don't think that removes the validity of it, but the way it was explained, I'm sure, gives some people heartburn, and I'll explain why later. There were allegations made between ourselves and other organizations that perhaps should be reconsidered, and it's that reconsideration that I want to present today. The seven individual candlesticks suggest to us that there is no ongoing oversight or interconnecting administration other than through Jesus Christ. Notice in the early verses of chapter 2, or is it, I'm sorry, chapter 1, which talks about him circulating among these seven churches. I don't have that written down, but I think I can find it quickly. Revelation chapter, I'm going to start in chapter 1, verse 12. Revelation 1, 12. "And I turned to see the voice that spoke with me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks. And in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as the flame of fire, and his feet like unto fine brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters." Very clear who this is describing. "And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun shineth in its strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. And he laid his right hand upon me, saying unto me, Fear not, for I am the first and the last. I am he that lives and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of hell and of death. Write these things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter, the mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden candlesticks. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven candlesticks which you saw are the seven churches. Now, verse 19 is particularly interesting because he shows something, he's telling us something that we need to consider in regard to this particular context. Verse 19, he says, write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. He's telling us that the messages to these seven churches have a historic application. They have a typical or a present application, and they have a future or prophetic application. And we need to keep those three things in mind. When we read these particular messages, we need to realize that they have a threefold application. These churches did exist. There was a historic application to these messages. He was speaking directly to people who were living the very things that he's talking about. And it's kind of strange. If any of these particular churches were to have looked at these messages, the first thing that they would say is, wow, this writer has visited my hometown. He knows us. He knows the characteristics of our people. He knows the geographical features of our region. And like I say, that book by Ramsey, Sir William Ramsey, describes the geographical situation of each of these churches and, by implication, some of their spiritual characteristics. He doesn't go so much into the prophetic sense, but he does cover the historic and the typical application of the messages. But it's very, very insightful. Whoever wrote these messages knew those people and knew the geographical layout of the town in which they lived. And he knew, in one case, the product that that town was famous for making, the eye-salve in Laodicea, for example. I would consider it curious if we ever got a message that described an arms manufacturing area or, some of the features, the major river that runs through our hometown or things of that nature. I would say that's amazing because whoever's writing this knows us intimately. And that was the case here. God walked among these candlesticks. He knew these people. Being present among them, they didn't realize it necessarily, but he knew their faults, their flaws, their character, their good features, and he talked to them about it. Now the problem is, the actual historic congregations never got the messages. Number one, the book of Revelation was written in the middle 90s AD. And many of these congregations had faded by that time. Number two, the book of Revelation was not generally accepted among the churches until long after. So the historic application didn't reach the people for whom it was intended. That would suggest to us that no, it's more intended for people later. So we need to understand the historic, the typical, and the prophetic application. Now, the typical application, and I'm sure many of us understand this, The typical application suggests that any person can fit any of these characteristics at any time. The prophetic doesn't change it that much. The prophetic would suggest that the eras exhibit those characteristics by and large. Not to discount that any person in any one could exhibit any one of the others. It's a little bit difficult to describe, but we need to recognize the distinction between the typical, which is what anyone could be, and the prophetic, which most theologians who understand this subject, secular or the church, true church, understand the prophetic to describe a series of eras that succeed one another from the time of Christ, the first century time of Christ, until his second coming. In Matthew 13:52, there's an interesting statement. Matthew 13:52, and this is what I hope to do today, is what this is suggesting. Because there are some things that we have traditionally understood about these eras that perhaps warrant a second look. 13:52. Then said he unto them, therefore, every scribe which is instructed unto the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder which brings forth out of his treasure things new and things old. I want to do that today. I want to bring out some things that are old, the things that we have understood, and I want to pose some considerations that I'm sure we would regard as new. One thing we need to understand is the prophetic applications are eras, not specific church organizations. An era is a span of time. An era can include multiple ministries, and most did. I want to go back to a publication put out by someone that we recognize as a scholar in the church, long history and teaching, but he identifies the Ephesian era from about 30 AD through 135 AD, roughly a century. And if that era was over by 100 AD, then obviously they didn't have a copy of the book of Revelation, which had just barely been written by that period of time. The Smyrna church he identifies as from about 135 to 450 AD. That would be the church led by Polycarp, Melito, Polycrates, and so on. That church existed for more than 300 years. The Pergamos church, he says, was predominant from about 450 to 1050. So that's about 600 years. So the first three church eras cover a span of time of about 1,000 years. And I notice he uses the term, these particular churches were predominant from this to that. In other words, they were the church that was active at the time that God was using. That's something we need to understand. Thyatira, he identifies as being about 1050 AD through 1600, which is another 550 years. Sardis, he says, was predominant from about 1600 to, interestingly, 1933, and I'll explain why he picks that date. And it includes the history of the Seventh-day Baptists, Seventh-day Adventists, and COG Seventh-day, for example. That era he identifies as having lasted for something over 300 years. Then he identifies the WCG as Philadelphia, and he has it extending from 1933 until 1986, interesting dates. That would, of course, encompass the ministry of Herbert Armstrong. That's what he identifies as the Philadelphian era. Now, that's a little different than what we used to teach. We used to teach that the Philadelphian era would extend right up until the second coming, and that the Laodicean era would exist only from the time of flight to the place of safety until the second coming, which only allowed them about 3.5 years for a whole church era. Some people might have had a little second thoughts about that. I know I did at the time. It just didn't seem logical that one era would only be 3.5 years. This particular scholar's expanded to about 40 years. But is it correct? Was our understanding at the time correct? Now let's back up for a minute and consider something. All of these Protestant scholars that we listed before, Halley and Schofield and Unger and so on, they all taught basically the same thing with respect to how long these church eras would be, from the founding of the church on the day of Pentecost until the second coming. All groups have assumed that the seven church eras end at the second coming. One thing to keep in mind, they didn't understand the millennial kingdom as we do. So why would they consider the church eras extending beyond the second coming? To them, the last trumpet will sound, all the saints will be carried up to heaven. The people left on the earth are all unconverted to be destroyed in the end time events that are going to occur at that time. They wouldn't have thought of the millennial kingdom. So why would they even have entertained the idea that perhaps that era could extend on into the millennial age? Is God going to be calling people? Is God going to be converting people or allowing them a period to become converted during the millennial era? That's something that's a little different, and I want to pose it just as food for thought. You don't have to agree with it. I have run it by some current ministers, and they can see a certain amount of logic in that question. But do all church eras end with the second coming? There's something else that's interesting here, and I was first alerted to this by a friend back in Connecticut back in the, had to be the middle 70s. He pointed out to me that there are three churches where Christ says to them, hold fast till I come. For example, in Thyatira, and remember that's the one that identified themselves with the fourth star, the Waldensian group and their heritage. But he says them in Revelation 2, verse 25, but that which you have already, hold fast till I come. Is he suggesting that that era will have a remnant still in existence at the second coming? Now, we might regard that as a strange question, but I want to show you something. And then in Revelation 3, verse 3, he says to Sardis, hold fast and repent. And in Revelation 3, verse 11, he says to Philadelphia, hold that fast which you have, that no man take thy crown. He's telling each of these three, and only these three, to hold fast till I come. Now, we in our teachings have generally believed that Sardis will still be in existence and still is in existence to this day. They're not necessarily the group that God is working through at the present time, but he did at one time in the past. But we are of the persuasion, and we taught, and hopefully still teach, that Sardis will still be in existence at the time of the second coming. Now, we say that of Philadelphia, for sure, because we thought we were the group that are going to be taken to a place of safety and we were going to be there until Christ returns. So we have two of the groups that we already would have taught would be in existence at the time of the second coming. So we're two-thirds of the way there. Are there any remnants of Thyatira which still teach the basic fundamental truths of God? I'm just opening that as a possibility. So we have three who were generally defunct during the first 1,000 years. We have three that are still, to some degree, active with existing remnants in the second 1,000 years. It's Laodicea that has been the enigma. Now, if our teachings were true, either the one that Laodicea began in 1986, or if it began at the time that Philadelphia flees to the place of safety, either one of those, we have to ask ourselves the question, when did those people become converted? To be a church of God, whether Laodicean or whatever, they have to have received God's Spirit. They had to have been evangelized and converted. Where do those people come from? If Laodicea only existed after 1986, let's say, when did they become converted? After 1986? Was there a large number of converted people who were converted at that time? We left ourselves in the position of having to say that no, these Laodiceans were converted during the Philadelphian era, under the Philadelphian ministry. That's what we put ourselves in the position of having to accept. So we've got two eras sort of commingled, developing together and separating only as the last few events take place. This is what we're forced to believe. Now, at the time, did we think about that? Did we ever say, is this logical? Can one era emerge from within the other? That's the basic question. And I want to pose to you today that whenever Laodicea begins, and I wouldn't doubt that we're in it today, to some degree at least, but whenever the Laodicean era begins, does it or does it not extend into the millennial age? Is there going to be a church of God in the millennium? And if so, what is going to be their primary problem area? Can we detect any of that in the message to Philadelphia? Let's look at Revelation chapter 3 and see what it says and see if it makes any sense as compared to our present understandings. Revelation chapter 3, he talks to Laodicea, beginning in chapter 14. I want to point out something else to here also. In all of the previous seven churches, he speaks to the city. Notice that. He speaks to Ephesus, he speaks to Thyatira, he speaks to Sardis, he speaks to Philadelphia as cities. But in Laodicea, he speaks to the people. Notice. Verse 14, and unto the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, these things saith the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. Right there we have a very profound statement. What does it mean, the beginning of the creation of God? We could say he's identifying himself. The speaker was the first to be brought from the physical form into the family of God as a spirit being. is this suggesting that there's going to be more people brought into the family of God as spirit beings? To be the beginning would suggest not the only, would it not? He goes on to say, I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I would prefer you be either cold or hot. If the Laodicean era was to extend into the millennial age, what do you think the problem would be with those people? Wouldn't it be the tendency to just float along with the flow? Most everybody is converted. Most everybody knows the truth. There's no false religion. Wouldn't it be so easy to just float along, not be particularly zealous about anything? Of course, in the typical application, that could apply to anyone at any time. But in the prophetic application, what would the primary problem be of converted people during the millennial age? Could it possibly be lukewarmness, just not sufficient zeal to pursue the calling that they're given? I know your works, that you're neither cold nor hot. I would prefer you be either cold or hot. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth. Because you say, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and knowest not that you are lukewarm, that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Are these people deceiving themselves? Does this sound like the condition of the world today? Now, we think of our own situation. Yes, we're a wealthy nation, and most of us are pretty well off. We have all we need. We might like more, but we're in pretty good shape compared to the rest of the history of the world. But these people are saying we have need of nothing. They're rich and increased with goods. Think of Kenya. Think of the nations of the world that are not affluent. Are there Laodiceans among them? This speaks of a worldwide prosperity. Does it not? It isn't just one small nation with perhaps 6% of the world's population that are saying this. This is talking about a time of great prosperity. Materially, they're in excellent shape. And they say so correctly. But it's the spiritual area that's the problem. You say you have need of nothing, and you're not aware of the fact that you're wretched and miserable and poor spiritually, and blind and naked, unclothed of righteousness. And he goes on to say, I counsel you to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that you may be rich, referring to spiritually, and white raiment, that you may be clothed, and that the shame of your nakedness do not appear, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see, a reference to the product in their hometown that they were famous for. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent. Get the overall picture of this message. These are people who are materially well off, but spiritually, they're just lukewarm. We can look at this in the typical sense. Anyone could be that way at any point in history. But in a prophetic sense, this is talking about a people who have that regard for themselves. They are obviously well off. But they are also obviously, to God, lackadaisical about it. Verse 19 again, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten, and be zealous therefore and repent. Behold, this is a very interesting picture. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and will sup with him and he with me. What is he saying there? That too is unique. In the previous three eras, he says, hold fast till I come. But in this one, he says, I'm already here. I stand at the door, your door. I'm on the other side of your door. I'm knocking on your door. Come to the door and open it up, and I will sup with you and be and you with me. Does that present a picture of the millennial era when Christ is available to anyone who wants to open up to him? I'm just offering that as a suggestion, not a conclusion. Think about it. To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. The opportunity to be brought into the spiritual family is open to these people. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the churches. Now, in our former teaching, well, let me back up. Where in this message to Laodicea do you see a reference to persecution or martyrdom or anything like that? Now, we took verse 18 as indicating that these people will all be martyred. Gerald Waterhouse, and I have it on tape and I have it in transcript. Gerald Waterhouse said that these Laodiceans are going to, their era is going to exist from the time that the Philadelphians are taken to the place of safety. And that they're all going to be martyred almost at the onset. And the basis for that idea is this statement, I counsel you to buy of me gold tried in fire that you may be rich. The gold tried in fire was compared to martyrdom of saints. They're martyred for their lukewarmness. They're martyred for their spiritual underdevelopment. That was our teaching. That was our idea. But he says, buy of me gold tried in the fire. Gold tried in the fire refers to spiritual character, refined spiritual character. He is the only source for that. Is this referring to physical persecution from the world? Otherwise, there is no reference here to deception or persecution or martyrdom anywhere in this message. I would say that more compares to the millennial era than it does to the present time, especially when there's really no time frame available to these people that could be regarded as an era. Now, in the revised scenario that's presented by that scholar that I referred to, he identifies the Philadelphian era as being from 1933 to 1986. Now, that would suggest that the Philadelphian era is tied directly to the ministry of just one person. But there's no other era where that would be possible, because 100 years, 300 years, 600 years, that could never be a single person. All of the other eras would have to have included the ministries of several different successive people. The era includes different ministries, not just one, but in our particular take on this, we would have Philadelphia being tied to the ministry of just one individual. And that creates another problem. Those who thought they were Philadelphia changed their belief system. And that forced a lot of groups out of that particular organization. And then those who came out turned around and said, well, the parent organization is now Laodicea. What was Philadelphia is now Laodicea. And what would have been regarded as Laodicea for going out of Philadelphia is regarded as Philadelphia. In other words, there's been a role reversal, a swap there. Does that make any sense, really? But that's sort of the situation that we found ourselves in when the situation developed that is described in the message to Philadelphia. Let's back up and look at that, because there's some interesting things there too. Begins in verse 7 of chapter 3:7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he that is holy, he that is true, that he has the key of David, he that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. This particular era had a period of time with an open door. I think we can identify that. And then it had a period of time where that door was closed and God's the one who closed it. But then in verse 8, an interesting thing. He says, I know your works. In other words, those who were faithful who continued to do those same works. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, and no man can shut it, for you have a little strength, and has kept my word, and has not denied my name. What we call the parent organization didn't like being called by the name of God. It changed its name to something else that didn't include the name of God. Whereas the groups that came out of her retained it. Behold, verse 9, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and to worship before your feet, and to know that I have loved you. Now, to be worshipped like that suggests to me that this is talking about people who are already made spirit beings. Does that suggest that the second coming is going to occur at the end of the Philadelphian era? We sort of taught that. It's just that where do we place Laodicea was the question. Verse 10, because you have kept the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. That's the period of time that we tried to identify with verse 18, buying gold tried in the fire. Are those two periods coincident, or are they talking about two separate periods of time? I will keep you from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which you have, that no man take thy crown. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out. This suggests that they have gone out at some point before, does it not? If you say you won't go there again, suggests you've been there before. You will go no more out. Suggests that these people at some point in time had to go out. When we consider the message of the open door, then the closed door, and then the reopened permanently door, when we see the suggestion of having to have had to go out, there are so many interesting comparisons to the Philadelphian experience that it's hard to overlook. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out, and I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the churches. I fully believe that there are things that we will understand more clearly as we come to, we draw to the end of this age. where Laodicea fits in the overall pattern, we could only speculate. Much of what we have taught historically on this has relied a great deal upon deduction or speculation. But keep in mind, these messages have three distinct applications. The historic, those congregations did exist. They did fit the descriptions made about them. The typical, which means that any person at any time could exhibit those characteristics. And also the prophetic. There is a prophetic series of churches that have existed down through history that Jesus Christ has personally been among, walking among them, advising them, guiding them in the way, using them for his purpose in their particular age to do his particular work at that time. How it's all going to play out is going to be very interesting. But who is Laodicea as an era? I don't know that we have an exact answer. I've posed you some things for thought. We had things that we taught in the past that were somewhat questionable. Let me give you some examples just quickly here. We taught that no two eras exist at the same time. I have the quote on that on tape. We have presumed that all eras end with the second coming. And it's a fundamental presumption of all the people who teach church eras. And we can understand why the Protestants would think that, but not necessarily those who understand the full implications of the biblical account. We taught that Laodicea exists between Philadelphia's flight and the second coming. It gives them about 3.5 years to exist, making it the shortest era in history, almost non-existent. We taught that all Laodiceans will be martyred nearly at the onset. And where did we get that teaching? Basically just from that gold, tried, and fire comment. When were those people who consist or comprise Laodicea, when were they converted? Were they converted in a different church era? That's sort of the idea that we have to accept, unless their era is successive to Philadelphia. When did they have opportunity to demonstrate their lukewarmness? They certainly wouldn't have been lukewarm after Philadelphia flees to the place of safety. We know when we taught that Philadelphia would exist right up to the second coming. Again, that leaves us with a problem. Where do we place Laodicea? Who among us saw the problems with our teachings at the time? Who gave it any thought? I don't know that anyone did. Perhaps people just let it pass and never gave it a thought. I don't know. I wanted to trigger our thought processes. Let's read God's word with a broader perspective. Maybe he's telling us more than we've accepted in this point. I can't say. But I think it's certainly worthy of our consideration that perhaps the church of God will continue to exist right through to the second resurrection and even a little bit beyond. Just food for thought.